I'm David Kern.
I'm Heidi White.
And I'm Sean Johnson.
And you are listening to Close Reads, a podcast for the incurable reader, on which we are discussing J.R.R. Tolkien's The Hobbit. We are discussing chapters 7 through 13 in particular, which means we are discussing the middle of the book. Before we do that, though, how's it going? Heidi, how are you?
All the blue sky behind you. I'm in Scottsdale. It's 82 degrees right now. I am living the dream.
You are living a different sort of dream than Bilbo is in this part of the book.
That is very true. That's true. And it is nice to read The Hobbit laying by the pool for so many reasons.
You're living what he was dreaming about while being soaking, trying to help those dwarves escape.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. All the iced tea kettle boiling.
Somebody
on the,
has to live in Rivendell.
Otherwise, when someone,
which I build my life.
It's true, because when someone needs to stop at Rivendell, then there won't be anyone there to care for them. You know,
that's right.
If no one, you got to practice Rivendell so that when other people need Rivendell, it's a well-oiled machine, which is the wrong metaphor. But
I get what you're saying, though.
It speaks to,
the keep the gears grinding so that other people can enjoy Rivendell. Yeah,
exactly. You're just making me feel bad about the metaphor even more, Sean. Sean, how are you?
I'm doing great. I'm one of those people who has to live in Wilderland so that other people can enjoy Rivendell or something like that. I don't know. I'm on vacation too, but I'm not in Scottsdale. Actually,
you're
I was
on spring break. Same as me.
Right.
I'm here on a
that's
mother-daughter
right.
trip with my best friend and our daughters. We actually just got back from a monastery where it was not Rivendell, although
fair
it was
enough.
Well, actually
in its
maybe
own
it was
way.
More like Rivendell.
Yeah, that's
now
right.
That I'm
that's
thinking
right.
about it,
an oasis
it was
in the
so
desert.
Lovely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Early church services, nuns, like it's beautiful. Yeah, an oasis in the desert of Safford, Arizona, we're well taken care of. It's just a delightful to go visit a monastery. Everybody should go visit a monastery at some point
right.
in their life.
That's right. I was born in Phoenix, and I really don't have any, most days I don't have any desire to return to the place of my birth.
Mm-hmm.
But I can appreciate the rest that you have entered into.
You wouldn't mind the version that Heidi is enduring right now.
We did a couple days at the monastery, Emily and I and our girls, and then now we rented a little Airbnb. And
there you go. Yeah.
And
you know,
Scottsdale.
That makes me think, do you think that the Thorin and Bill, they could have considered like a VRBO or an Airbnb? I feel like they really screwed that up.
Sometimes
I think that's
I
what they've sort of fallen
students,
into a couple of times.
Yeah. Sometimes I have my students like create a project. I've done this before for, you know, we have houses kind of like Harry Potter at the school where I teach. And I'll say a great house point project would be, how would Lord of the Rings have been different if everybody had cell phones? Right. And this is one of the ways.
Like crime novels.
Yeah.
Older crime novels are better because new crime novels, you just have a cell phone or the internet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Or like CSI, right? Like that.
Enhance. Back. No more.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Well, we are here to discuss The Hobbit. We are here to discuss the middle passages. We'll get to that in just a second. I want to say three things quickly. I want to let people know about three things. The first thing is not letting people know about. I just want to say Happy Easter, because we are recording this on Good Friday right now.
That's
You'll
right.
be listening to it the day after Easter. So from all of us here at Close Reads, Happy Easter to all of our...
Christ is risen.
Yeah, exactly.
Almost.
Yeah,
truly.
Yeah, right. Well, by the time they listen to this...
Yes.
Right.
And so, you know, now and for all time. And
now
exactly.
and for all time.
Onto the ages
moment.
Of ages.
That's right.
Yeah. So Happy Easter to all of our... Well, Protestant and like listeners, I know that those of you who are Orthodox,
Western
will be,
calendar,
or Western,
yeah,
right.
Western calendar, yeah, exactly. The Western calendar. Those of you who celebrate according to that, you're celebrating that. Those of you who are Orthodox, we know we have quite a few Orthodox listeners. So, to our Orthodox brethren, it's coming.
Endure,
hang
in there.
Yeah,
it's like a week of Lent for us.
Yeah, exactly. So, but truly, Happy Easter to everybody else who's listening. And
joyous feast.
Yeah, exactly. Also, Graham Pittman made me do this. He's making me remind you, let you all know that Withy Windle, the podcast that he and I do together, bookish podcast for kids, is coming back. It's coming back next week. Coming back on Tuesday, April 9th, with guests and snacks and riddles and conversations and story time and all the things that you love about Withy Windle, or that perhaps as parents you endure it being on in the car or in the background. And occasionally you chuckle, but at least your kids are occupied and you're welcome for that. But no, it's coming back, and we have a really good season coming up. And I think for snack time in the first episode, we might rank M&M, which is a big deal because I'm actually not.
How do you rank M&Ms?
There are a lot of crazy M&Ms now, Heidi.
There's peanut M&Ms. There's peanut butter M&Ms. There's
regular M&Ms.
There's pretzel M&Ms. M&Ms.
Yeah, exactly. So we're going to rank all those. Yeah.
Escargot M&Ms. It's nuts.
Exactly. And you know, you want to hear something that's crazy? Yes. I haven't eaten candy of any kind in like 3+ weeks. And so when I eat M&Ms on that episode.
You were on the road last week. I can't believe that.
I know, even on the road.
Wow. He's blinking twice, people.
I'm already packaging like a care package.
No, don't. No, I'm actually, it's just part of like Lenten discipline. I'm doing that thing. Growing up, we used to do that.
Glory to God.
We didn't do the... Growing up, we didn't do the traditional, like the Orthodox Lent and stuff, but we did do go without candy. And it was like, you know, one of those things. And so in our house, there's a whole dietary thing, right? So then what we're doing is we're adding ice cream.
If you don't listen to Withy Windle, you should know that David really does like candy quite a bit.
Yeah. Well, who doesn't really in the deepest part of their soul? Okay. The other thing is Lumen is coming. We've talked about it last week. It's the art curriculum that Bethany has been working on, and it's available for pre-order right now. And if you order between now and I think it's like April 3rd or something like that, you get 10% off, but you also get free shipping. So if you order between now and then in the next couple of days, you get both of those things, and that will save you. I'm going to guess shipping is somewhere between $5 and $10. And then also 10%. So depending on what you're getting, that's not, you know, it's not an insignificant amount of money. So you should probably get on that if you haven't already. So go to goldberryarts.com if you want to learn more about what Lumen is. But very proud of Bethany for what she's doing. And the more we work on it, the more we polish it and sharpen it and all that, the more good I think it's going to be. And also, just for those of you who are listening, our friend Mary Jo Tate, who is a copy editor and a line editor by trade. She's a longtime listener of the podcast. She's come to the retreats. She's a close reads stalwart. She's going to be helping us with some editing over the next few months too. So,
that's amazing.
Oh, wow. Shout out to her. Good.
Yeah,
wow, you've
exactly.
got a dream team on Lumen.
I know. I'm really excited about it, and I really don't have anything to do with it. So it's really fun to just, you know, get to watch other people create stuff.
Everybody.
Well, I'm just a support person in the background, but it's I'm really excited about. It's just really fun to work with people who are creating something great.
Project and it her is, yeah. like labor of love.
Yeah, yeah. She's been working on it for years.
David didn't have too much to do with it.
Swooping in and like helping with a few things, but okay. Well, let's talk about The Hobbit. It's the middle section, as I said, chapter 7 through 13. So there's some barrel racing of a sort. There's elven eating, elven song, elven capturing, elven prisons, elven woods. We also meet Smaug, the dragon. Bilbo uses the ring some more. And at the end, they've come into the cave. Into the mountain. And they've encountered the long-lost treasures. And Bilbo, in particular, has encountered a very particular important treasure that he's not telling anybody else about.
Yeah,
maybe because he's got a ring. You know, I don't know. Just because he's using this ring too much. Meanwhile, Smaug, however we're saying it,
I've heard it both ways.
He is off, and he is headed towards Lake Town. Last we heard, and that is where we leave off. I think that's enough of a summary for what we're going to get.
I think so.
Oh, Gandalf, incidentally, gone, not around.
Gandalf, where is that guy?
Spiders.
He's got.
Can somebody
business.
Please say something about the spiders?
There were spiders. There's some spiders. Yeah, there were spiders. Everyone should just see what Heidi just did with her parents.
Nightmares.
Like, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I sometimes lay in bed and try to think if the spiders in Harry Potter or The Hobbit are scarier.
I honestly think this is a genuinely great question for anybody who cares about stories to think about.
Yeah.
So I've got a question though. Speaking of spiders, actually, it's related. There's a couple things I want to talk about in this episode, and I feel like this really needs to get discussed. It's something I've thought about a lot since I was a kid, and I thought for a while maybe it was just a childish thing, one of those childish concerns that we have. But I'm really, the more I read this book, the more I need to know. Is everybody in this book actually just bad at their job? Is anybody good at their job? So first of all, I think maybe the dwarves really bad at their job. I mean, we know they're good at like making caves. That's been expressed.
Yeah.
Like doing things that involve
what's their job?
Making weaponry and stuff.
Yeah.
But as far as like journeying and, you know, adventuring and like staying alive and finding food and like not being idiots, are they good at their job? On that note, is it possible that Gandalf, in this case, bad at his job? Because what self-respecting, wise wizard sends Bilbo with people who are bad at their job, knowing that he's the only thing that's going to help him save the day is luck? Now, luck is a big theme in the book. I want to talk about that later. Bilbo, obviously pretty good at his job, but, you know, he did
not
have...
Not at first.
He does have
right.
a lot of He does have a lot of luck in, you know, on his side, and the book repeatedly references the notion of luck, and Bilbo is aware
you know,
of himself.
The one ring of power.
Right, which he comes across,
that's right.
Luckily.
Well, Gandalf knows he's lucky, yeah.
Okay, so Sean, say more about that, but really, honestly, is everybody bad at... like?
This is actually a really good question.
What is Tolkien's... like, is this on purpose? Like, everybody's kind of bad at their jobs, and then in the end, we won't talk about the end, but they go on this adventure. Or is it just a kid's story, and things happen, and he didn't think it through that much, and then when he gets into Lord of the Rings, he delves more deeply into the stakes and the consequences and all that. Sean, what do you think?
I definitely think it's not that last one. So we can take that off the table. I think Tolkien's always thinking about all the complexities.
From the record.
That's right.
Okay.
I was rereading this last week.
The Hobbit? We know.
The Hobbit. In addition to The Hobbit, I reread C.S. Lewis's original review of The Hobbit, in which he says something like, this is only for children, or it's only a book for children in so much as the first reading can occur in the nursery. Which is a great line. And so I think with that in mind, too, it would be folly to say that Tolkien failed to think too deeply or carefully because he knew this was merely a book for children. But I think that we do get in this section, Tolkien finally comes out, or the professorial narrator, who sounds a lot like Tolkien.
Yeah, right.
Finally comes right out.
English at any rate.
Yeah, at any rate. And he comes and says, listen, dwarves aren't heroic. I mean...
Yeah, you're right. He does. Yeah.
And I quote. Yeah, he says, this is just how dwarves are. They, you know, they would do what they can to save Bilbo in a pinch. They've done it before. But at the end of the day, this is kind of transactional for them. And what they really care about is gold. And they're not actually that heroic, especially when treasure is in the equation. I think that's intentional that we have all of these characters who aren't great at their job and become less great the closer they get to this thing that blinds them and makes them sort of sick. And that Bilbo is kind of on a different inverse trajectory, I think also masterminded by Gandalf, as to kind of come into his own and realize this potential to be particularly good at his job, as you said.
So you're saying that the whole thing is just Gandalf masterminding a way to bring hobbits out into the world to show what they're made of and to enable growth in Bilbo. That's what you're saying.
I think so. That's right. I mean, especially if you sort of allow the hobbit to exist in the Lord of the Rings and don't worry about the timeline of invention and authorship and stuff, then Gandalf's mission was always to come into the world and, see to its salvation, and that was going to happen through the small hands and efforts of hobbits. So yeah, I think that's right.
All right, Heidi, jump in. You unmuted yourself.
Yeah, I actually think Sean's right about this, but I think that that question for me is connected to the conversation that we had in the last episode about how The Hobbit, in my opinion, is enriched and deepened in light of Lord of the Rings, which came later. In this section, we have such a reversal of respect and competence happening between the dwarves and Bilbo. At the beginning of the novel, Bilbo is behind in everything, right? And he is unworthy of the weight of responsibility that is placed on him. And then that worthiness develops, right? He has his own kind of ordinary person hero's journey, which is probably best mirrored later on with Merry and Pippin in Lord of the Rings, although yeah. there's so much more at stake in Lord of the Rings, right? But Bilbo, all Bilbo has to be made worthy of is an adventure, right? Mm-hmm. He is on a quest, but it's nothing like the ring quest.
Right.
The stakes are much lower. The stakes are his life and the dwarves' property, and his life matters. And that's the whole point. That's the whole point that Sean is making, that somebody like Gandalf, who has this mantle of wisdom and responsibility that is far exceeds this dwarf's quest, is concerned with the trajectory of character and salvation of a hobbit. And I think that that's part of the moral vision of the story, is that that's worth this quest, right? And this quest is, we're seeing now in this section, there's this kind of growing awareness on the part of the reader that perhaps the quest itself has a moral flaw in it.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And that question is raised right now, and building towards something. But what we have is Gandalf, like the moral center of the novel is that Gandalf believes in Bilbo. And so, I think, Sean, yeah. you're right.
Well, then if you can question the moral center of the quest, then right. why would Gandalf send Bilbo along with that? Like if the idea is I've got to figure out how to prepare the hobbits for what's coming, or to, you know, however you phrased it, then really what he's doing is going around looking for a quest to bring the hobbits into, as opposed to hearing about the quest and being like trying to solve the solution of needing a burglar, and then he brings Bilbo into it. But then why would he send him on a quest that has its own moral conundrums? Like what is Gandalf's view on the morality of the quest itself then? I mean, he does get himself out of there ASAP.
Go ahead, Sean.
He's busy. He's got other things to do.
Yeah, but he's got to be in the South.
But if he may also view the quest as inevitable, right? If you listen to the dwarves talk at all about their treasure, and they sing about it all the time, they're gonna go at some point. They're gonna go, whatever happens, come hell or high water, and perhaps Gandalf knows that having Bilbo along we're starting to talk in terms of salvation now, but might actually save the quest, in that a humble and largely selfless and disinterested hobbit might be, you know, the best kind of balance to the gold lust or the dragon sickness that's driving the dwarves, and is also going to drive some of the other great figures that come into play as the, you know, climax approaches.
So, I do think we're supposed to question, to your point that you're making, Sean. Like I think that Gandalf is always the moral center of the story. Like I don't think that we're supposed to question Gandalf, but I also don't think that he's yet, until the Lord of the Rings, he hasn't earned the gravitas that he has in Lord of the Rings, right? Like we don't know what Gandalf is capable of. It's, for me, it's questionable if even Tolkien himself knew what Gandalf was capable of, right? Or what the hobbits were ever going to do, right? This was the first story. Lord of the Rings develops from this. It seems very clear to me that the ring is not as evil in this book as it is later.
Right.
And so on a literary sense, everything is still up for grabs. But mm-hmm. I do think that we're supposed to trust Gandalf in a way that we don't have to trust anybody else.
Yeah, agreed.
Like the dwarves, I don't, you know, and I think that's a huge mistake that the movies made. I'm not as hard on the Lord of the Rings movies as I am on the Hobbit movies. I don't have that purist mentality that some of our listeners do.
But those Hobbit movies are dumb.
They're terrible. And the reason is because they tried to make Thorin into some kind of Aragorn, and he's just not, right? And he doesn't have this like tragic flaw, like a like an Aristotelian tragic hubris. He's
well,
just
greed.
Yeah, well, yes, yeah. But they give it so much more weight in the movies.
Yeah, it's not hamartia, it's just a vice. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Although in a way I kind of understand why they would do that in a movie, because maybe there's not enough there.
Oh, there really isn't.
Not for three movies.
Yeah, right.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, you're exactly right. There is a lightheartedness in The Hobbit that we should just let live there, you know? And they just did it in the movies.
Well, the narrator is so quippy. I love that. I actually love how quippy he is. Like every now and then he just drops a little aside. And it's so very, it's like so English, right? And it's the kind of stuff you see in Tolkien's letters. And he's not, you know, like you can understand that this is a story that comes out of, it's burst out of the stories that he would tell his children. And I think that that makes it really enjoyable. Go ahead, Sean.
No, I was just thinking the same thing as I was reading this week. He does such a great job of managing the attention and expectation of the reader that shows a real attention to particularly young readers. But there's just enough foreshadowing. Well, we won't see the eagles again until the battle at the end of the book, but we won't talk about that right now. And they're just these little hints that keep you engaged and build excitement and anticipation, but without giving too much away.
You're probably smart enough to know that this is coming, but Bilbo hadn't yet thought of it
that's
until
right
now.
Yeah.
I actually think the voice of the narrator in this kind of, in a way, is archetypal for the best children's stories.
Yeah.
Where the narrator is knowing and wise and comic, but also brings the child into it, brings the reader into it. You know, it respects his intelligence, but also doles out information as he should, hold back just a bit of drama. Kind of, he doesn't hold your hand, but he gives you the signposts. He's like, the narrator himself is archetypal in the way that Gandalf is sort of archetypal for when they're journeying in the first part of the book. You know,
I think that's right.
He's there just enough. But then the story, I do wonder if Gandalf had to leave, otherwise too many problems. He becomes the cell phone, right?
Of course,
of the story.
Right.
Like you can just Google something, or you can make a phone call if Gandalf's there, right? And you can see him kind of having trouble with that, even when they're in the trees and the wolves and the wargs or whatever. And he's like, all right, Gandalf's just going to get us out of this, right? But then he has to be, he's too powerful. Like he's not just going to let people die. He's not just going to let it happen. But then, he has to leave for the real drama of the story to take over.
Yeah, especially the threat of the dragon. Even though we've seen Gandalf kind of come to the limits of his powers and abilities in the trees, with Gandalf around, Smaug is just not as terrifying and unbeatable
as
he needs to be. Or as clever. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so I think you're right. He had to get rid of Gandalf.
Yeah, before Mirkwood too. It's just the right spot.
Well, and Heidi already put it. Heidi already put it in terms of the hero's journey, right? And Gandalf is also like the Obi-Wan Kenobi that has to step out of the way, at least temporarily, so that the hero can come into their own.
And like Obi-Wan Kenobi, he will in the future, spoiler alert here, die, but then reappear.
That's right.
In his own way.
In a less Gnostic way.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. okay, so let's talk about this quest, though, like the morality of the quest. And do you think, is that a kind of thing that you think Tolkien is thinking about, Heidi? Or is it like kind of overly pedantic reading of it for us, like where we now have the Lord of the Rings and the whole Tolkien canon there for us? Or is he kind of, is this quest in like a sort of literary tradition that Tolkien would have loved, with, you know, the sort of medieval romantic quest and those kind of things? Is he just playing with that?
I think it's all of it. Go ahead. Finish your question.
And so maybe like he would be like, guys, why are you even asking this question about the morality of the quest? Or do you think that he does want us to think about that, even as it's part of another kind of tradition?
I absolutely believe he wants us to think about it. I think the complexity of this novel, this is not just a straightforward, there's not just a simple, straightforward moral vision for this. Like, it's not a cautionary tale that's like warning us against greed, but that's there, right? It's But there is a question of the morality of the quest that's in there. But there's also an upholding of the value of adventure and in the development of the heroic self, right? A lot of, I think, quite complex questions about the nature of ownership and heredity and what is owed, right? Like everybody in the story acknowledges Thorin's rights to this gold, right? It belongs to him. It's his inheritance. And so there is a rightness to his claim for it. And yet there's a risk to it because of the enchantment, right, of the gold. And Smaug is the true thief. Like, he keeps accusing the dwarves and Bilbo of being thieves. But he is, of course, the true thief. And so there's that question of, like, deception and enchantment and responsibility. What are you responsible for if you're enchanted? And that, of course, becomes more complex as the novel continues. But yeah, I think we're meant to let that whole thing kind of linger and then follow Bilbo through it, right? Mm-hmm. And see how he navigates it, because we are now moved into this place of, like, respect. Like, he's in it, kind of like Christ is to be in the world but not of it. That's Bilbo's position, like, right? Yeah. He is in it but not of it. And his role as kind of the vessel of that, I think, we're supposed to kind of follow him and navigate it through him.
We never thought about it that way.
Yeah, that's great.
He's in the journey, but not of it.
But not of the journey.
Sean, when I was talking, you kind of were like pointing at the screen.
Oh, yeah. I was just getting really excited. But Heidi nailed it. I think that's absolutely right. Although I'll get pedantic for a second. That's what I'm here for.
Awesome.
So in 1936... J.R.R. Tolkien gave a famous lecture. In fact, there are a lot of people who don't care at all that Tolkien wrote fiction and still revere him as one of the great thinkers of the 20th century.
Yeah.
And it's partly on the strength of this lecture that he gave. It was called Beowulf, the Monsters and the Critics. And it sort of single-handedly revived Beowulf scholarship.
Quick question, quick interruption for you.
Come on.
Do you just have this off the dome, or did you prepare this?
No. This is a big one for me. You know,
okay. All right. No, I'm just curious.
It's a big deal.
It's just right there. All right. Okay, go ahead.
And in this lecture, he makes a case for restoring Beowulf to this place in literary studies, not just as a historical relic to be, like, broken apart and carbon dated. To learn about how the Anglo-Saxons, like, laid out their houses or, you know, did their taxes, but as a story. Yeah. And he makes general arguments about the value of fantasy literature and the imaginative, you know, escape and return that are made possible through fantastical fantasy literature like Beowulf. And this was 5 weeks after he delivered the manuscript of The Hobbit to his publishers. And so there's no way that he was not thinking about his own fiction as he said all this. And in this section, we get, I think, the closest Beowulf parallels. The third act of Beowulf is all about how a thief finds a dragon's treasure trove and steals a cup and awakens the dragon's wrath. And the dragon goes about burning everything and ends up burning Beowulf's longhouse. And so Beowulf has to go and fight the dragon, or does he? Right, and so Beowulf, the poem, culminates in all of these moral ambiguities about how much the king Beowulf is motivated by treasure, and how much he's motivated by honor and the protection of his own people. And even when he kills the dragon and dies himself, spoiler alert, but it's like 3,000 years old. So where you been? It's not that old. That's close.
1,500.
Yeah.
1430, something like that.
He dies and he leaves this pile of treasure, which ends up being actually presenting a greater danger to his
his people, maybe even than the dragon. And so there are all of these morally ambiguous questions about Beowulf's motives and the treasure and the gold and the dragon. And I think Tolkien has all of those things working in his head as he's writing this children's story. I think it's meant to be complicated, but complicated in a way that can be digested, you know, in the nursery, as Lewis said, which is really brilliant that he pulls off.
And at minimum, and within that tradition storytelling, which he is so steeped in. I mean, he did his own translation, which maybe we should do on the bonus show someday.
Oh man, that'd be great.
Although we might like have a mass unsubscribe if we read Beowulf over there. Heidi, do you? Well, you just unmuted yourself. Were you going to add something to what Sean was saying?
No, okay. I was just getting ready to answer your question. I am ready,
well,
David.
First,
I don't even know what it is.
First, Sean, if people want to read that, is it just online? Is there a book that it's in? What would you recommend?
I think you can find it.
Do you have it memorized and you're going to do a recording?
I'll just recite it now if you want.
That'd be great.
It's published. It's published along with some other essays in a book by that title, Beowulf, the Monsters and the Critics. I think you can find the text of it online.
It's very easily accessible online. You can get it in PDF, print it off. Like it's,
Heidi, what I was going to ask you is, I know you're a fan of you're a fan of the epics and you're a fan of the medievals as well. In what ways do you think that this book was participating? I mean, I know there's what Sean just said was specifically with Beowulf, but in what ways do you think that Beowulf, and I suppose, even more precisely than Tolkien's work, but if you want to talk about Tolkien's work in general, that's fine. But in what ways is this participating in that tradition? And I know that that tradition itself is tied closely to Christianity as well. But how do you see him responding to that or participating in it or wanting to work within that tradition?
First of all, one of the things that I love about Tolkien is how... two parts. One, how intentional he is to place himself within an existing tradition, and that is part of what he's doing with his fiction, as Sean said, this when the Beowulf essay came out. And there are other examples of this in his work, when he's intentionally timing his own release of his work along with something with an advance in scholarship and they're brought together not out of self-promotion but out of a sincere desire to contribute to something that he just deeply loved and believed in and saw being lost in the academy and in the public square He was writing his fiction as an antidote for what he considered to be failures in modern scholarship and modern literature. And he was writing at the same time of some of the modern authors we love, right? But he considered that there was a deep loss in the storytelling of his age. And he wanted to create something that was worthy of inclusion in this wider kind of tradition, literary tradition that he taught and that he loved and welded and contributed to on a scholarly level. And he also wanted to contribute to it on a creative level. And he did. And the other thing that I see in him is just delight. Like he just seems like he's having so much fun crafting a story that's part of this tradition that he had real and thoughtful and scholarly goals for, right? Like he was trying to do something purposefully, but he just also seems like he's having the best time, just writing about wizards and dragons and gold and quests and making up hobbits in the Shire. And you know, the more you read about the Inklings, you hear about his rousing debates with Lewis over elves and Father Christmas and all these things that they sparred about. And for Tolkien, he was trying to recover an imaginative experience that was being lost in the public square. And so what I noticed was certainly some epic things like the quest, right? Like the homecoming, the there and back again idea. there's a lot of classical allusions in his work, but I see more medieval in The Hobbit. Fairy tales, quest narratives, Beowulf. And I also see a lot of biblical themes in his work as well, with Gandalf as this kind of Holy Spirit figure, which is very medieval. And then also Bjorn reminds me like so much of John the Baptist, right? Like even with like the locusts and the honey and the dwelling in the deserts, there's this kind of monastic life that Bjorn is living that again is medieval, but traces back to the Bible as well.
There are a lot of vocationally celibate characters.
Very much so.
Tolkien's stories.
And solitary, like very much, and that's very medieval, right? Like people in medieval quests knights are always meeting like maidens in the woods or hermits who give them some kind of help and information that helps them accomplish their quest. But even that in the medieval tradition is a callback to the biblical tradition and a tie-in with monasticism and the vision of the monastic life. And just Tolkien just seems like he's having like the best time in the world putting all this together for kids.
Yeah. But it's so invitational. I really wanted it to end in Ori.
Inviting, yeah.
I just really wanted it to, but there's not really a way. Yeah. So invitational or inviting is really where we need to go. Much to my chagrin. But he's playing with language. He's, you know, all those things that you're talking about. And he's taking all of these images and these archetypes and all that. And that could easily be not inviting, right? It could easily feel like if you don't recognize them, you're being left out, or you're not getting the joke, or you're not getting the references, or it could feel super academic. And he manages somehow to pack his stories with all these things that he loves and that he knows about and that he cares about and that he wants to preserve, while also making it so if you don't know any of that, it's still a ripping yarn, right? Yeah. And I think that's where the true genius is. Like that's what makes him someone who lasts and lasts and lasts. And we all care about him, and he's going to last into the future. And you know, you generations and generations will read him because he can combine those two things. Which in a way is sort of why like Shakespeare or Homer is still around, right? Because there's a ripping yarn that you want to experience, that you want to participate in, and there's also all the other stuff. And that's like the greatest literature ever. Like that's one of the things that makes it distinct and what makes literature that we pass on. Period.
Totally agree. Here.
So I want to take a quick break because I want to talk about something that is related. I want to have a little segment before we go to the end of the episode, because I want to talk about the bracket, the final eight. Tolkien, of course, is participating in this. So it's not, I'm not doing this truly.
Yeah, he's still in there too.
We're down. By the time this goes up, I think we'll be down to the final four. But at the time that we record this, there are four matchups, which means that there are eight first lines in our 2024 literary bracket. One line to rule them all. And when Graham and I came up with one line to rule them all, we were pretty proud of that one. It was really just hanging there, but
yeah,
you know,
right.
We enjoyed that. So in matchup one, we have Pride and Prejudice and The Divine Comedy. And you guys should all be pleased that The Divine Comedy did rally.
I am pleased.
It did make the final
eight. This pleases me. Yeah.
It's a tough matchup here against...
It's a super... These are tough and all of them are worthy.
Yeah, that's right.
So Pride and Prejudice, it is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife, is up against... Midway upon the journey of our life, I found myself in a dark wilderness, for I had wandered from the straight and true. And yes, I know that there are other translations available to that, so it goes. My thinking was that on the ones that were translated, you can substitute whichever one you like best it. That's kind of how I was thinking about it.
Is that the Esalen one?
I believe that is the Esalen one.
Okay. It is.
So right now, Pride and Prejudice does have 67% of the vote to 33% of the vote. How will you feel, Sean, when Pride and Prejudice moves on to the final four at the cost of The Divine Comedy's opening line?
I will feel pained, but without the sting of injustice. I mean, I think it's a fair fought fight. Yeah. I will tip my hat to Jane Austen.
It is an unassailably great first line. Is it the greatest line ever? Well, that's what our audience is deciding. But and also time. Yeah, Heidi, what do you think of that?
I agree. I actually just honestly don't know what should win on those two. I think that I think that Divine Comedy is truer.
Well, right. That's even in the world of Pride and Prejudice, the opening line isn't meant to be true.
Yeah, but
which in some ways makes it genius.
That's true. That's right.
If you were to ask me on the street, name like say a first line of a novel, I would quote Pride and Prejudice.
Yeah, that's right.
So, well, I don't know. Like, I just think those two. I will say that the middler in my life that I am, the more I like that Divine Comedy line. Right. I will say that right now.
The middler in your life.
Yes.
There's a Bette Midler joke there to be made. Yeah. Well, if someone came up to me on the road and asked about a first line, I would probably say The Hobbit because I have a poor memory and it's a short line. And so that's our other matchup. We have Anna Karenina, Happy Families Are All Alike. Every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way, is up against the first line of The Hobbit, which, as you know, begins with "In a hole in the ground, there lived a hobbit." Sean, your take on this. Right now, The Hobbit has 54% of the vote and looks like it might knock out Anna Karenina, which, given how beloved it is, I'm not surprised about. But it's also, you know, a close matchup. So what do you think?
This one is really, really hard for me. This one's harder than matchup number one.
You mean to vote on or that you...
To decide how I feel.
Okay.
Yeah. So the fun personal trivia, a short book about Anna Karenina is the only thing that I draw royalties from. And which
so
means
far.
That...
There's got to be, you know, you never know what the future
is. The next decade of my life, as soon as my children start sleeping through the night, I'm going to become extremely productive.
You're
going to
be in a dark wood. That's where you're going to be.
That's right. I'm going to blow them right out of that wood.
You know what people have to do in dark woods. They write books. Yeah.
Thank you.
But, I mean, The Hobbit is it's The Hobbit. I love that opening line of Tolstoy's. I've used it in wedding toasts. I think about it all the time.
I would love to hear the rest of you said that in a wedding, like in as someone's getting married. You said that to all the families that were there.
Oh yeah,
that's amazing.
And then everybody, you know, like for the rest of the night, people were slapping me on the back, telling me about the great toast. So
Bilbo's toast about how you never know. Do you really like anybody there? And are you?
Oh yeah, that's classic.
Yeah.
I actually had one woman come up to me and say, I'm so mad because I am going to be in a wedding next month and I was going to use that line in my toast, but now I feel like I can't. And I
said, did you give her permission?
Did you say,
I don't own the copyright.
First I said, you snooze, you lose. But then I said, you can do an even better job. So
it's not really fair to accuse someone of snoozing when the weddings were just scheduled at different times.
I acknowledge that ultimately, yeah, it's true.
Heidi, where are you on this one?
I can go either way on this one.
I'll just be happy no matter what.
Yeah.
Which is a relief after round one.
Voted on this. We voted this round in the car on our road trip. Emily and I and the girls driving yesterday. And we just did consensus. Mm-hmm, raised hands around the... Because these are hard. Like,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's a couple of them that I'm like, I can't pick. This one, I mean, I think that The Hobbit is more iconic than Anna Karenina as a novel. And but man, that line from Anna Karenina is just, it's so good and true.
It's so good.
Again,
and true.
It's truer.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's talk about this third one then. We have the Christmas Carol corner. The Charles Dickens corner, which in Dickens v. Dickens. Yeah. We got A Tale of Two Cities. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times and so forth versus Marley Was Dead to begin with. Heidi, you go first on this one. What was your consensus in the
it's
car?
It's a Christmas Carol for me. I love A Tale of Two Cities opening line, but I just think Dickens just talks too much. Man, that guy's wordy. So I'm with Marley.
A Tale of Two Cities will win. It looks like it's up 55% to 45%. But I voted for Christmas Carol as well. Yeah, yeah. I mean, Marley Was Dead to begin with is a really great opening line.
I also voted Christmas Carol. I think it's just, it's so great.
I'm not going to be upset.
No, I know. A Tale of Two Cities is a great, great, great opening, really, 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 really long sentence.
Yeah, deservedly famous.
If it wins, I won't be surprised or shocked.
Yeah, I think it's
really
fair.
Disappointed.
Yeah.
But I'll be like, it probably won't be the one that I don't have a ton of affection for it, but I have a lot of respect for it.
Like if you got this final as a tattoo, it would be like your whole back.
It would be Parker's back in words. Okay, so matchup four is Call Me Ishmael from Moby Dick versus The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. There was a boy called Eustace Clarence Scrub, and he almost deserved it. Which one?
Dawn Treader.
Okay, yeah, I agree. And that's the way it's going to shake out. It's 85 to 15%. I do think there is a chance that this matchup between A Tale of Two Cities and The Voyage of the Dawn Treader is going to be very interesting to me.
Yeah.
I think there's a chance that we get Pride and Prejudice versus Voyage of the Dawn Treader in the
final.
It's really just, in the final matchup, it's really just a question of when it comes down to it, do people feel like they have to vote for A Tale of Two Cities because of how notable it is, and they don't feel like they can vote for a children's book? Because I think that the Eustace Clarence Scrub line is one of the best lines of any book ever written, regardless of first line or not, but especially as a first line.
So
it's going to be very interesting. I think the final four will be difficult and probably pretty close.
Exciting.
Okay, so that's
really
a quick,
like these. I just really like these matchups in the Elite Eight. Like they're so poetically perfect against one another. Like, Call Me Ishmael. You're Eustace Clarence. So it's like the battle of the names. Then it's like Dickens v. Dickens.
Also ships.
And then four of just like how can you pick? You know, how can you pick between Divine Comedy and Pride and Prejudice? It's just it's kind of like when you're watching a great. Like NBA matchup, and you're like, whoever's ahead 2 points when the buzzer goes off is going to win that. It's not about like they're equally matched.
Yeah, it's just they ran out of time. Yeah. So when I was setting up the
sports ball, by the way, what I just did. Thank
sports
you.
Sports brackets in the first right, which is where March Madness, is inspiration comes from.
Oh, is that where it comes?
Do you know about that, Sean?
Do they still do that?
They do all these years later.
David's a little mad at you, and I think it's fair.
I'm not mad at all.
They still use so the when peach we, baskets when I was.
All right, let David talk.
Yes,
let
Sean.
The man talk.
When I was setting up the original matchups, the first round, I was just setting up the first round matchups, and I was thinking about themes and all those different kinds of things. And I loved the idea of having these two Dickens matchups in the Elite Eight. I didn't know it was going to happen, but I thought that if it could happen, that would be really fun. But then I really liked the idea of Moby Dick and Voyage of the Dawn Treader going against each other just purely for the nautical themes. I didn't really expect it to happen, but here we are and I'm enjoying it thoroughly. So
exciting.
Yeah, agreed.
Okay, well, let's conclude our conversation on The Hobbit. Do you guys think, I'm not going to ask you, but whether you think people are good at their jobs and all that kind of stuff. The question of heroism does come up here at the end of the section.
Yes, it does.
And it mentions dwarves are not heroes. And Heidi, you talked last week about how the next book, The Lord of the Rings, is actually about heroes.
Mm-hmm.
But then this theme of heroism comes up closely connected both in the text and then also just, thematically with the question of luck. And so one of the things that I'm wondering is, as we get to the end of the book, do you think that Tolkien is exploring or playing with the notion of Bilbo and heroism? Like, are we supposed to think of Bilbo as becoming a hero as this story goes on, Heidi? Sean, you can just jump in whenever you disagree with Heidi.
Great.
I think that the answer to that is yes and no. Yes, in the sense that we absolutely see him developing heroic qualities and both competency wise, like he's getting to your earlier thing that you brought up, like he's getting better at his job, right? And then he's more agile, he's quicker on his feet, can think more quickly, he's braver, right? Like those kinds of things. He's overcome these obstacles through luck, through the ring, and then also through his own wits and his own courage. Also, and he's developing morally as a character. He's he's becoming more selfless. All of those kind of true heroic qualities. However, so there's the yes. On the no side, I think also that one of the things that Tolkien is doing is playing with our expectations of heroism and kind of redefining heroism and saying, what if a hero is just a hobbit, like just an ordinary person who lives in a hole in the ground, right? Is it possible for an unexpected kind of person with no kind of like high ranking potential for rule, like he's never going to become a king. He's going to go back home and wash his pocket handkerchief, right?
He's going to write books now that he's in the middle of his life.
Right. Exactly. Yes. He's going to find himself in Darkwood. And he literally does, but he's also figuratively going to happen. It's going to happen. Happens to all of us. And so I think that...
Are you going through something?
Always, right?
Always.
So I do think that Tolkien is playing with our expectations of heroism and kind of redefining it. And I think that that works particularly well for a children's book because he is talking to kids who don't see themselves as heroes, right? And that's one of the reasons why this book is so enduring. And I can just see Tolkien kind of scratching his head, like, I'm inventing this whole race of creatures that live in holes in ground and eat seed cakes and they want to live like middle-aged people, right? Like that's who they are. And that's like part of who they are. And so how am I going to make that person appealing to a child? And he succeeds because the same kind of unexpected heroics of the ordinary kind of person are expected and developed in Bilbo. And a child can relate to that.
Yeah.
I think he does something in addition to that, which maybe we'll have to talk about more next week. But Tolkien has sown throughout The Hobbit this theme of a world in decay, or the loss of a greater world, not only in the immediate sense of the dwarves and their kingdom under the mountain, but also there's a line in this week's reading about how language itself has become less capable of describing, you know, the wonders that Bilbo feels when he sees the treasure. And we're going to meet another figure who emerges as a hero in the final chapters of the book, Bard, spoiler alert. And he lives in this world that is very sort of autocratic and kind of business oriented. And the leader of Lake Town is kind of this bureaucratic manager who's interested in money. And in that kind of world, Bard doesn't distinguish himself, but in connecting himself to the older world that has sort of been eclipsed, he is able to find the means of delivering his community and emerging as this person with some sort of capacity to rule. And so Tolkien also, I think, is going to give us that sort of hero as well. But there is something different about between Bard and Bilbo, but also something shared.
What you both are saying is kind of prompting me to think about how often I have thought about it. Tolkien as a soldier when reading this book this time. And especially I've noticed it when I've been listening to it, the Andy Serkis reading. Because when Bilbo he's having dreams about, you know, being home, or he's thinking about the wood, or he gets hit in the face with the wind, or he thinks about how he's not going to be able to take another step, or he feels like he's having some good luck. All those things, or maybe he survived because of good luck. All those things seem so deeply felt in the way that they're interwoven into the story. And I think that that's connected, like the things he must have felt well as a young man in a different sort of
that's great
world on, in his own journey. That's tied to what you guys, I think, are saying there, even to Bard. And I think we could, you know, it's obviously there all in so many scenes in Tolkien's work, whether it's Frodo and Sam on the mountainside or, you know, all different battle scenes or his contemplations of courage or whatever it is. That so often Tolkien's experiences there play into it. And the way he explores the themes seems so tied to what he endured himself. Right. But you also wonder if he was able to endure them because of the stories that he had. And so stories themselves, maybe not endure it physically per se, but endure the mental and spiritual carnage that the war brought on so many people. So that, you know, that it's tied into what you guys are saying there. Let's wrap this episode up. I just got to get back to, what are you doing sitting by a pool? You got busy,
yeah,
busy things to do.
I am. So I can go all service. Day. Yes.
Yeah. she, every now and then she just looks wistfully over at the rippling water on the top of the pool, sparkling in the sunshine. She looks longingly.
I'm actually glad that's not true, because what else am I going to do? Sit around and talk about The Hobbit? That's like the best part of my day.
That's right.
Well, so, you know, you got
what you're doing. Right,
you get your daughter
be.
And your best friend over there. And, you know, it's, you know, we got to let you go get to it. We don't really, what we're thinking of is them. They're waiting for you, I'm sure.
Yes, this is a selfless, you know, act.
Going to go to dinner or something. Sean?
I am making dinner tonight. I'm making ramen.
What are you making?
Ooh. Ramen.
Oh, nice.
I mean, you're like you're making ramen?
I'm making ramen. Okay. I'm making real ramen.
Nice. I took one of my kids to a Thai restaurant the other night. He likes ramen, but he'll even eat the instant stuff. And he was like, oh man, do I get the real ramen? Just like, I don't know, this is like too highbrow. I encouraged him to do it. He went with a different soup instead.
Fair.
Sean,
it's all delicious.
What are you doing next?
This is going to be.
I'm going to go make shrimp tacos.
Super pious, delicious. But I'm going to church and then choir practice.
Nice.
No.
Yeah.
Nice. We are all doing the work.
Yeah, that's right. Shrimp tacos that's sound true. Great though.
Make me sound super pious. I mean, you're engaging in a bit of piety. That's exactly what you're doing.
Yeah, that's right.
Glory to God.
Yeah.
All right. Well, don't forget about the daily poem, which is also one of the ways Sean engages in a bit of piety. he's bringing you poems every day to add to your day. Don't forget about Worthy Window coming soon. Don't forget that the Lumen is available to pre-order. And if you do it in the next couple days before April 3rd, you can get free shipping and a 10% discount. Don't forget also about Logan, who produces these podcasts, who edits them, who makes them sound better and takes out the stuff that we need to take out and sometimes leaves it in because he thinks it's funny. He also does yeoman's work on Withy Windle in particular. So, and then what else we need to talk about? Don't forget to vote in the final four.
Kristen Lavin's daughter.
Yes. Kristen Lavin's daughter, which the newest episode just went up a couple days ago. Sean and Heidi did that on a day when I couldn't make it. But then the last thing I want to do is I want to ask a question about The Hobbit that I'd like to hear from people. I want to ask you, what do your kids most love about The Hobbit? So those of you who have kids or perhaps your teacher, if your kids have heard this story, listened to it, read it, been, you know, you've read it to them, it's part of your family life in any way or your classroom life, ask your kids what they love most about this book and post it in the comment thread underneath this episode. Because I'm really curious to know what makes this book most speak to children. We're past that point. And I think that we have some guesses, but I'd love to hear specifically how the kids would say it. So post that in the thread on Substack, closereads.substack.com underneath this episode. I would love to know that. So we'll just kind of make that like a question of the week. And if we get a few responses, we'll share those on the show and we'll discuss.
I'm going to do
not
my
only the
research.
End of the book, but why this book, you can ask your kids why this book stands out so much as a children's book, because I think that's a different question. We've talked about it a little bit, but it's a very specific place to go with it. So we'll talk about hobbits and dragons and treasure next week when we continue. But for now, for Heidi White, for Sean Johnson, I'm David Kern. Thanks so much for listening. And until next time, happy reading.